It is 84 degrees under fair skies. From WPSW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
All right, and the previous program was the Gary Null Show, which is heard daily at noon. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Patrick Roy Bates, a major in the British Army during World War II, later a pirate radio broadcaster and a self-made millionaire who imported rubber, owned a chain of barbershops, and sold seaweed in New York, sought in 1967 to escape what he called the world's damn bureaucracy as he declared Sealand to be a sovereign nation. In his latest book, Dylan Taylor Lehman takes us 7.5 miles off the coast of Essex, England, in the North Sea, where Patty Bates and his family established a micronation in international waters. Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family, is published by Diversion Books and brings Dylan Taylor Lehman to our show now. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Don't you live in the foothills of Appalachia? How did you come across the story of the Principality of Sealand?
Yeah, that's right. I'm from Zanesville, Ohio, so just in the barely earliest foothills, so that's a bit of a brag on my part. But I'm not even quite sure how I came across the story that for the first time. I mean, it's certainly been well over a decade ago that I learned about it, and I came about it, you know, if you read the book, you'll see that there's a pretty strange exile government side story, and that was my first introduction, and so that was a pretty weird way to get involved with all this, but then I, of course, realized it was more about the Bates family and all their accomplishments over the decades, so that's really where, you know, what caught my interest and prompted me to dive even deeper into this story.
And it's a rather incredible story, full of interpretations of British law, international intrigue, a number of armed invasions. Have I left anything out?
Well, let's see, the, you know, challenges to internet law. There's the Sealand flag on the top of Mount Everest. So, yeah, just the the side stories here are pretty endless for sure.
Now, Sealand is often called an island, but isn't it really a decommissioned and abandoned anti-aircraft gun platform that's not all that big, the size of two tennis courts?
Yeah, it's about just over 5,000 square feet, and it's entirely man-made, and it's one of what are known as the Moncel Sea Forts, which are a series of forts built in the Thames Estuary during World War II. Which were intended, of course, to defend against incoming Nazi bombers and submarines. And they sat more or less abandoned following the resolution of World War II until the Bates family and many other enterprising people, you know, thought that they would serve a new purpose and began taking them over again in the early 1960s.
Can you just take them over? By the way, before we start, should we call him Roy or Patty Bates? What do you prefer?
Patty Roy Bates does have kind of a more poetic ring to it, but according to his son, Michael, everyone who knew him just called him Roy. So yeah, Roy Bates will work.
Okay, so this also involves the story of pirate radio stations. What led to the widespread creation of pirate radio stations in the UK in the 1960s? Were they going into competition with the BBC, which had a monopoly?
Yeah, kind of unbelievably in the 1960s, actually from the founding of the BBC in the 20s up until the 1960s, they were the only licensed broadcaster in the UK. And so listeners were essentially at the mercy of whatever the BBC wanted to play. And they were known to play, you know, an hour or two of rock music here or there, or commission their own bands to do you know, fairly tepid interpretations of rock music on air. And so a lot of these, DJs who just wanted to hear rock and roll music began to take over these sports or, you know, build boats outfitted, or sorry, outfit boats with radio transmitting equipment and sail into international waters to broadcast music, which was often from their own record collections. And so this phenomenon caught on with all the youngsters, and the enterprise just really took off from there and became a pretty Robin Hoodian, you know, pretty well-regarded and celebrated era in British history.
Well, actually, first it was Radio Luxembourg, which was broadcasting from Europe. Then came these things, mostly boats, as you mentioned. Some of them were pretty popular in the early 60s, Radio Caroline and Radio London, when Roy Bates started his pirate station, Radio Essex. Now, what did he do? He he didn't go to the Fort Ruff's Tower where he created this country first. He went to another tower, and that was a problem?
Yeah, so he went to another one of these Moncel forts called Fort Knockjohn, which was 3 miles from British shoreline, which that distance would, you know, play a big part in why Sealand has developed in the way it has. And yeah, I mean, it was a totally seat of the pants operation. I mean, hauling out their own equipment and lifting it up with ropes, you know, building their own transmitting equipment, eating, you know, endless stores of canned beans and things like that. But, you know, all the DJs were just along for the ride, and you know, not only Roy Bates Station, but everyone really talked about what a just kind of revolutionary fun it was at the time. So they had,
but it was within 3 miles of the main of the British mainland. So it was not in international waters. That meant that it was illegal, right?
Yeah. So once the British government started finding and arresting radio DJs, Roy Bates, his turn came up and had to go to court. And as part of the prosecution, yes, they determined that although 3 miles was the official designation, they determined this fort was just inside that distance. And so that, of course, prompted them to seek out somewhere a little further afield.
And how did he acquire the Fort Ruff's Tower? Weren't there already pirate radio broadcasters there?
They definitely, the forts made obvious sense for these offshore stations. And so there was a bit of back and forth that kind of established Roy Bates and his crew's reputation as pirates, essentially, because they definitely got into some fist fights, some scuffles out there that ultimately resulted in Roy and his crew maintaining ownership of the fort.
And he got his equipment partly from American, right? Stuff that had been left behind.
I'm not quite sure about. I know that, you know, he used some old naval transmitting equipment and again sort of cobbled together their own, you know, a very DIY enterprise. I mean, I know one of the electrical wires was said to be just strung across precariously and people had to make sure to duck that lest they be, you know, electrocuted.
He was the first to offer 24-hour broadcasts. Were they playing American rock mostly, or American and British rock? This is the time of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it was a little bit of everything. I mean, Roy wasn't necessarily a fan of rock and roll music and called, I think, the Rolling Stones, you heard a demo tape of theirs and called it, you know, rubbish. But yeah, American and English and British music, but they also, Radio Essex was also known as one of the first stations to really, you know, take ads from local advertisers and deliver local news, whereas a lot of the other stations were a little bit more national in scope and not quite as specific to that region. So that's kind of the niche that Radio Essex filled.
So he was fined £100 for illegal broadcasting, and he then moved to the Fort Ruff's Tower, where he began broadcasting for how long?
Well, they did move to Ruff's Tower, which was indisputably in international waters. It's about 6.5 miles from British shorelines. And up at that point, the BBC had kind of acquiesced to public demand and started some other radio stations that did play rock and roll music. So the necessity of a pirate station wasn't quite as pressing. So Roy, in turn, had this other fort and decided to just, use it to pursue some other enterprises.
Yeah, the BBC created Radio One, its own pop radio station in 1967, which I assume cut into the listenership of the pirate radio stations. So he decided to do other things. Let's talk a bit about the family. Wasn't his wife Joan a beauty queen? How had they met?
Yeah, they met in 1948 at a local dance hall. And, as I write in the book, it was kind of like one of those scenes in the movies where they catch each other's eye and the music gets all fuzzy and they just immediately fall in love and were married within 6 weeks. She was a model and another from the area as well. And they essentially, established their whirlwind romance right away and jumped in full steam ahead to whatever endeavors that they wanted to pursue. And, Roy had it in his mind to lead a fairly unconventional life, and Joan was right there helping him out with it and, certainly doing her fair share of the work as well.
What had life been like for Roy and Joan in Essex before they moved to the platform?
Fortunately, I was able to talk to some people who actually knew them. Roy and Joan are unfortunately since passed away, but I mean, they were known as very sociable, very, he was always well-dressed. I mean, he was an ex-military man, so he sort of carried himself in that regard. They had high society aspirations. I mean, their kids, horse riding lessons, they had a Bentley, all that kind of thing. But, there's a story, I don't know how apocryphal or not this is, but Roy, one day on a train to work, realized everyone was around him was wearing the same suit and hat and carrying a briefcase. And he realized he did not want to be part of that, threw his briefcase in the lake when he got off at his stop. And they began a lot of the pursuits that you had mentioned at the top of the program.
And they had two children, a son, Michael, who plays a major role in the story, and a daughter, Penny.
Right.
So did they decide to just move to the platform? What was it like when they got there, and when did they move there, and how did they make it habitable?
It was certainly an uphill battle in every sense of the word. I mean, their home base was in Southend-on-Sea, which is in Essex, right on the Thames estuary in southeastern England. But it was a pretty crazy journey. I mean, they would have to take all their supplies by car to a bus stop and then walk it down a road to a rowboat to go to their puttering old boat, which was left over from the war, and then a pretty lengthy journey out to sea. And then they would in turn have to haul all of this stuff up onto the fort. And so it was a very, very, very difficult process to make this fort habitable, which already was, cold, windy. It's cement and steel, so it's certainly not, a luxury accommodation. But over the months and years following taking over the fort, I mean, they outfitted it with the trappings of home and gradually made it, a tolerable place to be.
Now, they were originally broadcasting as Radio Essex, but then they changed their name in October 1966 to Britain's Better Music Station, BBMS. Mm-hmm. And that didn't last long. Why did they change the name, and why did they wind up going off the air on Christmas Day in 1966?
Well, the following the court case that determined that the original fort was well within British jurisdiction, that's when they moved out to Ruff's Tower and established what would become Sealand. But, as we had discussed, by that point, the BBC had expanded the repertoire of music it played, and so that obviated the need for a new radio station. And so this BBMS actually didn't end up getting off of the ground, but that it did provide the impetus to take over this new fort, even though they didn't ultimately go through with that program, or with that plan, rather.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. My guest is Dylan Taylor Lehman. His latest book is Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family. It's published by Divergent Books. So, okay, so he stops broadcasting, but then he decides to declare the island, the Principality of Sealand, a sovereign nation in 1967. What led to that decision?
Well, I was fortunate enough to meet with his son, Michael, who explained to me that Roy was pretty put off by how doggedly the British government had gone after him for his radio enterprise, especially since he was a fairly celebrated war hero. And so although Roy and the family might not necessarily have had concrete ideas in mind for what wanted to come next, they figured that since they had this location in international waters, endowing it with statehood would, you know, serve whatever purpose came next pretty well. And so that, I guess, you know, was just kind of the logical next step. You know, it wasn't just something that they had acquired, but rather something that they had full control over as sovereign rulers.
And was he planning to bring the station back, or did he have other ideas for this new principality of Sealand?
The radio issue was fairly, that had been over and done with. That was out of the question. I think it was kind of unclear what he hoped would come next, but the thinking was to just set it up and endow it with as much officialdom as could be possible for whatever it was that could become next. And Roy did, you know, actively pursue various business endeavors that would take place on the fort and benefit from a location in international waters. So there were a few things brewing right away. And at the very least, I mean, they started issuing stamps and coins and various other things to, again, underscore their position as an independent entity out at sea.
Is there a legal process involved in declaring yourself a principality? And in this case, Roy Bates making himself the prince of the principality?
There's no real legal guidelines for... that's kind of part of the really complex part of the story, was because the fact that this fort was in international waters made its legal status fairly unclear and very... could be argued on paper, certainly, that he did have total control over it. And that too, would set the stage for some legal battles that would be forthcoming that would make this, the legal status and the international status of the fort even more complex. But on paper, definitely, he did a lot of research to see what latitude he had to make these declarations, and on paper it seemed like, yeah, he was certainly well within his rights to declare this fort to be his own country. The question, of course, was who and what nations would agree with those claims.
And whether the UN would accept it, and sure, we'll get to that in a little bit. But I mentioned invasions. So, and I mentioned Radio Caroline, which was a major pirate radio station. Ronan O'Rahilly, is it? Rahilly, along with a small group of men, try to storm the platform. What were they trying to do? Take it over and establish a radio station of their own there?
Yeah, I mean, as mentioned, I mean, the locations of these forts was kind of key to their extra legal status and, you know, being outside of British jurisdiction for broadcasting purposes. And so, yeah, there really were some quite pitched battles to hold on to these forts involving, you know, Molotov cocktails, gunfire, boatloads of people, hired hands from the nearby docks to come out and try to take it by force. So, you know, I think that some of the violence that happened out there really also kind of forced the British government's hand to take these, what was otherwise a fairly, kind of lovable pirate radio enterprise and, you know, treat it a little more seriously.
Well, the battle actually attracted the Royal Navy to Ruff's Towers. And when they came too close to Sealand, didn't Michael Bates fire warning shots at them? Because he said that they had entered what he claimed were Sealand's territorial waters.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a pretty remarkable part of the story because I think Michael was around 14 or 15 at the time, and his dad had, left the decision about whether or not to use gunfire up to him, which is a pretty, heady responsibility for a teenager. But, that too really, prompted the British government to take this whole situation more seriously because, You know, you can't have someone shooting at boats out there. But again, the family claimed it was in defense of their own territory, and that would lead to some court cases that would make their claims, depending on how you looked at it, make their claims a little more concrete. But at the same time, the British.
Go ahead. I was going to say they were arrested and charged on weapons charges, but then the court threw out the case. And you were getting to that, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, I think that decision surprised even the Bates family. I mean, the judge ruled that because the fort was so far away from official British territorial waters that, the British government really didn't, their authority didn't extend out to the fort. And, that really took the family by surprise. And, to this day is certainly cited as one of the kind of most important moments in Sealand's history, because it did suggest that, not necessarily that Sealand was its own country, but at least it was independent from British authority.
Although, as I understand it, the boundaries of territorial waters have been extended more recently, which would complicate the situation. But as you say, Bates took the judge's decision as a de facto recognition of his country. And then 7 years later, he issued a constitution, a flag, a national anthem, also started issuing passport stamps and sold nobility titles on the internet. Well, I guess he had to make a living.
Yeah, I mean, and that was the idea from the beginning, was to, take this extraterritorial status that he had complete control over and use it to some, financially beneficial ends. And it wasn't until, fairly recently with the advent of the internet that it did start to become as profitable and self-sustaining as Roy had envisioned. But yeah, I mean, there were definitely tons of really interesting business experiments that took place on the fort, that resulted directly from its unclear international status.
And Brexit has brought new funds and new people into the story.
Yeah, I mean, definitely with the whole Brexit controversy and, other worldwide controversies like Trump's election in 2016, people certainly were petitioning the Bates family for Sealandic citizenship. they haven't been granting that quite regularly, but, as you mentioned, you can buy Sealandic titles from the government's website to help keep the enterprise afloat.
I love the motto that they gave themselves. A mare libertas, or from the sea, freedom.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely encapsulates everything that they stood for.
And then there was another invasion. In 1978, a group led by a German businessman named Alexander Achenbach tried to take over Sealand. What were their motives? And there were Dutch people also involved in the attempted coup?
Yeah, in the early 1970s, the Bates family struck up a partnership with these German and Dutch businessmen to just do something with the fort, expand its footprint. I mean, establish hotels, docking docks for passing boats, that kind of thing. And initially, it was quite a productive partnership because all of these, they were very good about it. Writing to dignitaries of foreign governments to try to get recognition to the UN, fundraising, all this stuff. But the background of these characters would quickly come to light when, they were involved with some other illegal enterprises unrelated to Sealand. But this would all come to a head in 1978 when they took Michael hostage when he was alone on the fort in an attempt to take over the fort for themselves.
And then Michael Bates and others launch a counterattack in the early hours of the morning to recapture the fort. And he wound up holding some German and Dutch men as prisoners. All but one were released. But didn't this lead to an international crisis of sorts?
Yeah, I mean, all action movie stuff aside, I mean, they rappelled down ropes off of a helicopter with a shot. Michael had a shotgun tied around his neck with a piece of rope. and they retook the fort. But when they in turn held these captors hostage, the German government was petitioning the British government to do something about this. But in a, you know, kind of interesting turn of events, the British government said, you know, this is really outside of our control. And so I believe it was a member of the local German embassy in the UK flew out to the fort to negotiate these prisoners' release, which again is, you know, another kind of diplomatic event that the Sealanders use to underscore the fact that they are an independent entity, you know, that it necessitated the involvement of an official from a foreign government.
But Germany has denied that it was a de facto recognition of Sealand. Is Sealand officially recognized by any established sovereign state? By England, no. For example?
It is not, although throughout its history, there have been some overtures of recognition that are perhaps accidental from representatives of other governments, but its primary kind of supporters are governments of entities of similarly, I guess, unofficial legal status or unofficial statehood status.
What's the UN's position on Sealand? Has it had to decide on it?
Well, there was a quote from an official who once said, "We have a nut file for applications like this." So, you know, they unfortunately have not extended recognition. But, you know, as the world changes, perhaps that will change as well.
Well, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which has been in force since 1994, states, artificial islands, installations, and structures do not possess the status of islands. They have no territorial sea of their own, and their presence does not affect the delimitation of the territorial sea, the exclusive economic zone, or the continental shelf. And I'm assuming that was their way of dealing with Sealand and anybody who wanted to create a similar micronation.
Yes. However, supporters of Sealand have also argued that, similar to other treaties, the treaty you mentioned doesn't have a retroactivity clause, which means that anything that was declared before that treaty went into effect is not affected by the newer treaty, which means that perhaps it is the case that since Sealand was declared sovereign in 1967, that these claims preclude that exclusion that you had just mentioned.
Although, as I said, the now territorial waters have been extended to the end of the continental shelf, so Sealand would be within Britain's territorial waters. Has that ever been resolved?
Not officially, although, of course, the Sealand government, in retaliation, expanded their territorial waters, which now encompasses part of England. So, you know, it's just kind of at loggerheads in that respect. But, you know, I think the British government today just kind of lets them do their thing because it's not really hurting anybody. So it's more of a quirky endeavor, you know, carried out by some, you know, kind of independent-minded Englishmen.
Although there have been scams and illegal activities connected with it. Did the Bates family ever live on the island full time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Michael Bates, who is now 67, 68 years old, said he estimates that he spent, you know, cumulative about 20 years of his life cumulatively on the fort. And Roy was very stubborn and would stay there for weeks at a time, even into old age. So, I mean, he definitely, you know, very much took Sealand seriously. And today the fort is maintained by two full-time caretakers who alternate at the very least 2-week shifts on the fort. So there definitely is someone out on the fort at any given time.
I mentioned some illegal activities. Haven't scam artists and others used Sealand for gain? For example, wasn't there a fake website selling fraudulent Sealandic documents and paperwork that involved a lot of 80 people worldwide?
Oh, definitely. And let me point out first, of course, that this all happened without the Sealandic royal family's involvement or consent or anything like that. So this was, you know, had nothing to do with them. But Yeah, a gang of international criminals seized on Sealand's uncertain extraterritorial status to try to do some money laundering, to register ships, to buy airplanes, to take out bank loans. Yeah, just a really fascinating spread of criminal conspiracies based on Sealand.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Let's listen to the Sealand National Anthem. Before I get back to my guest, Dylan Taylor Lehman, I need to take a moment to ask you to consider becoming a member of WBAI. We need all of our loyal listeners to step up right now and go to our website, give2wbai.org, or to call 516-620-3602 to help keep this show and this station on the air during this terrible pandemic. Again, that number is 516-620-3602, 516-620-3602, or go to our website, give2wbai.org. That's give and then the number 2, wbai.org. And one great way to support WBAI throughout the year and also spread out your own financial commitment so that it's only a small amount taken out of your credit card or bank account each month is to become a sustaining member of the station, what we call a BAI buddy. So let me take this opportunity to thank all of our wonderful listeners who have become BAI buddies during this fun drive. Listeners like Joseph Hughes of Elizabeth, New Jersey. Thanks, Joe. And to everyone who's helping to keep the show coming to you. Joining me now is the executive producer of this show, Jesse Lent, to tell you about a special offer to anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy during today's show. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, Leonard. Yes, that is true. Anyone who signs up to become a BAI buddy, that's a sustaining member, by making a contribution of $10 or more a month in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large, if you do that today, you will receive a free copy of the book that Leonard has been discussing, Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family, by our guest, the author, Dylan Taylor Lehman, as our way of saying thank you for supporting the broadcast that we're bringing you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m. with Leonard Lopate at Large. In order to do that, you can go to the web. Our website is give2wbai.org. That's give, then the number 2wbai.org. We also have operators standing by, so to speak. If you call 516-620-3602, and you can get a copy of this book, Sealand, the true story of the world's most stubborn micronation and its eccentric royal family. Now, Leonard, obviously, we've been doing shows on all the myriad ways that the pandemic is affecting our life. We've done social movements going on in the streets right now and hope to do a lot more on that. But today's show is really a nice kind of departure from everything that's happening right now. I think we all need an escape from time to time, no?
But it is a fascinating story, and we thought that our listeners might be interested in hearing it. And I'm very happy to be talking with Mr. Taylor Lehman about it.
You know, I'll tell you one thing that was interesting to me was all of the radio history in this book. You know, just reading the press, full disclosure, I do not read every single book we do on the show. I have not read Sealand. And just, you know, preparing the show and reading the press, I did about ceiling. I did not expect for there to be this really fascinating radio component back in the days when pirate broadcasters were actually on sort of pirate ships in a way off of the coast of the UK and other parts of Europe.
Well, it's because really interesting.
Sure. So if there's any.
Interestingly, public broadcasting in England, the BBC, is paid for by everyone, whether they listen to the station or watch the TV shows or not. They have to pay a license fee. We don't do that. We ask our listeners to come forward and support us because they believe in what we do. And they don't have to become BAI buddies, although I think that's it's a great way to support the station, also get this book. But they can. You can just call in and offer any amount that you're comfortable with. It can be $10 a month or more, as we do with BAI Buddies, or it can be $10 for the year or $100 for the year. Whatever level you're able to
just
show your
support.
Just a
one-shot deal is fine.
Yeah, please. And if you are already a member and you haven't renewed, how about renewing now? We hope that you'll show your support for this show and for the station that brings it to you every weekday from 1 to 2 p.m. If Leonard Lopate at Large has been a part of your daily life, consider stepping up for listeners who are just discovering it and give them the gift of the hour of conversation, insight, and knowledge that we hope to bring you with each installment of this program. But we can only do it with the support of listeners like you. And Jesse, one more time, how can they help?
Yes, speaking of gifts, you
Your
know, this is something that would make a wonderful gift. Yes, I've been having trouble with the connection today for some reason. But yes, if you call right now, 516-620-3602, or go to the web at givetowbai.org, give then the number 2, wbai.org, as we've been saying. That's a sustaining member for a monthly contribution of $10 or more in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. You will receive a free copy of the book that Leonard has been discussing today with our guest, Dylan Taylor Lehman. That is Mr. Taylor Lehman's book, Sealand, The True Story of the World's Most Stubborn Micronation and Its Eccentric Royal Family. That will be sent to you if you become a BAI buddy in the name of Leonard Lopate at Large. But as Leonard was saying, whatever level you're able to contribute in this complicated time for all of us.
Oops.
I mean, really, every single contribution is keeping the lights on here. So it seems like we're having some connection problems, but if you can still hear me, the number is 516-620-3602. The web is givetowbai.org. And from all of us at the show and the station, thank you very much.
And I'm going to go back to my guest, Dylan. You mentioned earlier that you interviewed people involved, including family members. What was their response? Were they happy to talk about this? Were there things that you didn't know about because they never made it into the news stories?
Oh, absolutely. And let me give a shout out here to Prince Michael's book. The Sealanders self-published his own autobiography in 2015. It's called Holding the Fort. And that's, you know, kind of a firsthand account of what it's like to grow up doing what they did. And, you know, I'd kind of framed my book as a journalistic counterpart to Michael's first person account. So check that out for sure. Initially, because they had this book out, they were a little wary of me co-opting their story. But, you know, since I kind of flesh out some of the other context surrounding the fort, you know, they were ultimately happy to work with me. And it was definitely great getting some the inside scoop on all of this because, you know, after having researched it for so long, I had a pretty good understanding of, you know, all of the events that were discussed in public and being able to get, you know, some more to flesh out those stories a little more, just get some inside information was really a special experience, and I definitely appreciated them inviting me into their houses and spending so much time telling me all of this and answering all of my no doubt irritating at times questions.
Is Prince Michael still living on the island, or I'm calling it an island on whatever the platform?
No, he and his two sons, who were in their early 30s, they run a cockle fishing business. So they harvest some edible mollusks off the shores of where they live. So they're, you know, essentially doing that full time, and they all live in the UK at this point, but do go out to Sealand, you know, for various special events or to do, you know, help with the upkeep and that sort of thing.
Right now, Sealand is largely financed through their online shopping mall, which is run by the Bates family, although on the mainland. And the mall's merchandise is priced not in Sealand dollars, but in British pounds, sterling. Obviously, people don't have Sealand dollars. So they sell mugs for a little under 10 pounds, titles of nobility for around 30 pounds. And they also rent space for offshore data storage. So it's a nice business, and it seems to have inspired others. Didn't a group create a nonprofit organization called the Seasteading Institute in 2008? What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, that's not, you know, related to the Sealanders, but it's certainly influenced by them. And that is kind of a theoretical, although they have been attempting some physical construction, but it's playing with the idea of building floating cities out at sea that would be able to exist in international waters according to their own rules. And the idea being that these different types of communities would spring up governed by, you know, the principles favored by their founders, and they would be free to kind of conduct business as they see fit in international waters in, you know, city-sized floating enclaves. And so that's, yeah, I mean, they've attempted some of these, again, physical constructions, but I mean, as you can probably imagine, that's a pretty humongous undertaking. And so that's still in the works. But yeah, definitely building on the idea of what kind of society is possible out at sea.
As I understand it, there's now just a full-time guard who lives there as the only permanent resident of Sealand. Why did the family eventually return to the mainland?
I mean, it's certainly very difficult to live out there. I mean, the only way up onto or off of the fort is a mechanical winch that has to be operated by somebody on the fort or by helicopter if you can afford it. And so once you're out there, I mean, you know, everything has to be imported. And although it can be quite peaceful and fun to stay there, I mean, it's also you're essentially in a house in the middle of the sea. So, you know, if you're not one for isolation like that, it could be a little bit trying for sure.
Hasn't the title of Prince of Sealand been passed on now to the grandson of Roy and Joan Bates?
Yeah, so Prince Michael is effectively stepped back, although he is, you know, does still conduct interviews and kind of directs the direction of the country. But
Prince Regent now.
Right. A lot of the promotional stuff and, you know, the upkeep is done by Michael's sons, Liam and James, who, as you mentioned, are Roy's grandsons. And they're the ones that, you know, being millennials who have kind of helped propel Sealand into the internet age. And that's facilitated the sales of these titles and, you know, a pretty charming presence on social media. You know, there's like footage of them hauling a McDonald's takeout order up to the platform or decorating it for Halloween and just, you know, kind of having fun with the whole history while also, you know, of course, taking seriously its legacy and everything that it does stand for today.
Roy died of Alzheimer's in 2012, back in Essex. What about Joan? When did she die?
Joan passed away from natural causes in 2016.
So now it's all been inherited by Michael and the whatever happened to their daughter?
Penny, who's now 70, I was fortunate enough to spend a lot of time with her, and she, you know, obviously is really appreciative of the unconventional childhood she had. But, you know, after spending weeks at a time stranded out there as a youngster, you know, she quickly realized that this wasn't the life for her. And so she kind of divested her dealings with the family project and went her own way. Now she operates in, she's an esthetician, operates a beauty clinic in Essex. But yeah, I mean, it was just not a life she wanted to lead. And so she kind of stopped being involved with the running of the fort in the late 70s.
I'm assuming there are many unclaimed plots of land like Sealand around England and throughout the world, tiny islands and international waters. Could any of them, these unclaimed plots of land, be turned into micronations like Sealand? Or have they all been claimed by now?
That's a pretty good question because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the treaties that have been signed do now take into account kind of obscure islands or outcroppings or man-made structures that do clamp down on people claiming them as their own. There are here and there a few territories, some on land that are either disputed by neighboring countries or in the case of an area in Africa, the way that two maps were redrawn, both countries accidentally excluded this little patch of land. And so that still today is officially unclaimed. But I mean, certainly in today's world, it's increasingly difficult to find somewhere, especially relatively close to shore, that isn't, you know, claimed by whoever is most close by to it.
You write for narratively, and most of the stories have been about super subcultures like Sealand. But you've also written about the band of people who search for Sasquatch. What is it about these subcultures that appeals to you?
I really like the fact that, you know, people are living life on their own terms, and I certainly like diving into you know, whether it's Bigfoot hunters or semi-truck thieves or, you know, the history of the Spanish tortilla. I just really like learning the backstories of stuff that I don't know a whole lot about, and certainly talking to people who are very invested in these things, it's always refreshing to see that kind of passion. And so I simply like learning about stuff, and, you know, being able to write about it just allows me to pursue it in even more depth and just satisfy my own curiosity. And it's fortunately other people seem to think that some of the stuff I write about is interesting too, and it's just given me license to check out all kinds of interesting things.
This past January, you wrote a piece for Narratively that strikes me as having some significance these days about corruption in the Florida Supreme Court in the 1970s. What was happening there, and what was the most shocking aspect of that story for you?
I was reading a book about called Among the Lowest of the Dead, about the country's attempts to reinstitute the death penalty. And there was a passing, and Florida being kind of the battleground for that, and there was a passing mention in that book about how at one point the majority of Florida Supreme Court justices were under investigation and facing jail time all essentially at the same time. And I, you know, that of course struck me, and I looked into it more, and yeah, it was just unbelievably rife with corruption. And yeah, certainly at the, you know, three justices were being investigated at once, and for fairly serious charges. And so that, as you mentioned, was definitely relevant to today's analysis of today's political climate and, you know, scrutiny people are paying to politicians.
The corruption was in the Florida State Supreme Court. Why there? Aren't Supreme Court justices appointed by the governor with the consent of the state legislature?
When all this corruption came to light, that upended the process by which Supreme Court justices get into office. Because at the time, they campaigned as any politician would, and so they were certainly open to influence by, you know, businesses or organizations or whoever it was, you know, that wanted them on the court. And so, you know, just coming from that sort of environment, that level of corruption and then pandering to their supporters just kind of led them down some pretty dark, although comically corrupt paths.
And now Florida is the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic, worse than even New York at its worst. And New York is a much bigger state. Do you see any links, or is this just a coincidence? Are there any enduring effects of the history of Florida's judicial system on the current situation in Florida?
I mean, from what I understand, looking over the history of Florida Supreme Court, I mean, it seemed like there was, you know, following these justices being exposed, sort of a few years of, you know, reinvigorated sense of integrity and wanting to do justice, you know, to the public. But I think just over time, just as you can imagine, you know, influence crept back in. And so although I can't speak for the political climate in Florida today, I mean, I imagine some of the similar, you know, that influence is at play and, you know, has led to the things being the way that they are.
If I wanted to purchase a noble title from Sealand, is mm-hmm. there a website I would go to?
Yeah, the official Sealand website is sealandgov.org. And you can buy, everything from titles that run, you know, $50 up to, I think, a baronetcy, or maybe it's a lordship, is, you know, up to $800. So, but again, all of that helps to keep Sealand afloat.
Well, it doesn't have to stay afloat. It's on these pillars, aren't they? Isn't it?
Yeah. So, absolutely.
Is there any pirate radio in England anymore, or is that totally gone? And is Radio Luxembourg still broadcasting? Do you know?
I think that Radio Caroline still is in existence, although, you know, I don't think it has to operate in the piratical way that it did before. But, you know, I'm sure there are certainly people who are running radio stations under the radar, though I guess with the internet today, that, you know, the necessity of doing that isn't quite as intense. I mean, I'm sure you can run a program without a whole lot of oversight, but on the internet, I mean.
Well, one of the big differences between the British situation and ours is the BBC doesn't run commercials, but these independent radio stations were able to take ads. In this country, a station like WBAI doesn't run commercials, but American broadcasting is pretty much run on advertising.
Yeah,
and that was kind of. I don't know if you see an irony there.
Well, and that was kind of the original, something I found admirable about the founding of the BBC, that it was designed to be free of the, what did they call it? They had a pretty good insult for the, you know, intrusions of commercial advertising, as in radio in the U.S. So I thought, you know, initially that efforts to do that were pretty admirable for sure.
I want to thank you so much for being on our show today. It's been a lot of fun talking with you. Dylan Taylor Lehman, his book Sealand, The True Story of the World's Most Stubborn Micronation and Its Eccentric Royal Family, from Diversion Books. Have you found another eccentric story to tell?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I lived in El Paso, Texas for a while and got to know and become friendly with a private eye there named J.J. Arms, who is now... he's about to be 88 years old. He's been a practicing private eye for over 60 years, and he blew his hands off with dynamite when he was a kid, and so he has two hooks for hands, but that has really helped him, you know, craft this larger-than-life reputation for himself and get himself involved in all kinds of wild capers. So I'm working on a biography of him and a deep look at some of his, you know, the interesting life he's led and some of the cases that he's worked on.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show.
And this was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to segment producer Kate Guan Allison, who prepared today's interview. If you're just discovering this program and you like what you've been hearing, you can access past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org, We're also available as an iTunes podcast, and you can find links to all of our past shows on our website, LeonardLopateAtLarge.org, or .com, I think, in that case. Don't forget to follow our show pages on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to reach me directly, you can write me at LeonardLopate@WBAI.org. As I mentioned before, WBAI is in a very difficult position because of the pandemic. So if you value the kind of informative, in-depth interviews that we bring you weekdays from 1 to 2 p.m., please go right now to our website, give2wbai.org. That's given the number 2wbai.org, or call 516-620-3602. Help keep community radio alive in the New York metropolitan area. And we hope you'll join us tomorrow when one of our regular contributors to this show, Pete Murawski, will discuss summer gardening in the age of COVID-19. You can email me at LeonardLopate@WBAI.org with any gardening questions you have for Pete, because we can't take calls these days. I'll do my best to work them into the show. Again, that email address is LeonardLopate@WBAI.org. And we'll see you tomorrow.
Dr. Watkins, I believe if you give those tomatoes some shade,
take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Mohammed. Here are some headlines. The World Health Organization reports 230,000 new coronavirus cases were reported across the globe on Sunday, the highest single-day total since the pandemic began. More than 100,000 new coronavirus cases were identified in the United States over the weekend. The total number of cases has now surpassed 3.3 million in this country. More than 135,000 people have died from the disease in the U.S. Florida recorded 15,000 new coronavirus cases on Sunday, setting a new single-day high for any state. If Florida were a country, it would rank fourth worldwide for the most new daily cases after the United States, Brazil, and India, according to a Reuters analysis. But Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis continues to downplay the pandemic and has refused to impose a new lockdown or to order residents to wear face masks. In a rare piece of good news, health officials in New York City reported zero coronavirus-related deaths on Sunday for the first time in the course of the pandemic. The first coronavirus-linked death in New York City was reported 4 months ago on March 11th. Since that time, the city has recorded 18,000 confirmed deaths from the virus. Washington, D.C. reported 64 new coronavirus cases yesterday for a total of 10,743 confirmed cases. D.C. reported no new COVID-19 related deaths, keeping total fatalities at 568. The district recalculated its rate of community spread, saying the city has experienced 9 days of sustained decrease in community spread. It appears that D.C. Health determined an earlier increase in community spread did not constitute a new peak. The district has managed a contact trace for 99% of new cases within 1 day of the case being reported. After decades of calling for change, It's going to happen. The NFL team in Washington has finally buckled under pressure and will officially change its racist team name. Owner Daniel Snyder had long vowed he would never change the name, despite Native American groups and others calling it offensive. But after FedEx, whose president and chairman owns a stake in the franchise, demanded on July 2nd that the name be retired, Snyder changed his tune. In a statement released today, the team announced it will be retiring the name and logo at the conclusion.